Well, good evening, brothers and sisters. Tonight's class brings to a close our studies of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. These studies have considered the efforts made by the Jews in Jerusalem to first rebuild the temple and then repair the walls of the city. But the most important part of a temple is not the grandeur of the building, but the spirit of the worshippers. Similarly, the most important part of a city's defence is not the strength of the wall, but the extent of the occupant's faith in God. So tonight we will look at how the inhabitants of Jerusalem were strengthened, both in physical numbers and in their faith. We finished the last study with the completion and dedication of the wall of Jerusalem. But in achieving that goal, Nehemiah recognised that constructing the wall was only part of the job. The Samaritan threat was still very real, and so vigilant watchmen would need to be on guard, otherwise the work they had laboured so diligently to achieve might be wasted. Well, Nehemiah took such precautions as were possible and practical, as we see from chapter 7 and verse 3. In Nehemiah 7 verse 3 he gives the following instructions. Do not let the gates of Jerusalem be opened until the sun is hot. And while they stand guard, let them shut and bar the doors. And appoint guards from among the inhabitants of Jerusalem, one at his watch station and another in front of his own house. Well, the convention was that city gates were opened at sunrise and closed at sunset. But here we see Nehemiah instructs the gates be kept shut until mid-morning, in order that all the city's population would be awake and alert to man the defences should a surprise attack be mounted. In addition, the residents who lived on the wall were required to keep watch, in addition to the lookouts placed at strategic stations around the wall. But the allocation of these duties highlighted the problem that remained. These defensive resources were stretched very thinly. As we see from Nehemiah chapter 7 and verse 4, there were just not enough people living in the city. Now the city was large and spacious, but the people in it were few, and the houses were not rebuilt. Well, it is generally reckoned that the circumference of the city walls was about 6 miles in the times of Nehemiah. And although several tens of thousands of Jews had returned, first under Zerubbabel and then with Ezra, many of those returning Jews had settled in the outlying villages in order to be close to the land which provided their living. Furthermore, living in Jerusalem was not an attractive option, since although the city walls were now rebuilt, the houses inside had not. You may remember that the initial wave of returned exiles had been criticised by the prophet Haggai for dwelling in sealed houses, evidently spacious and comfortable. So it would take a special kind of person to give up the comfort and convenience of an established and comfortable home in the country for an uncertain and potentially dangerous new dwelling place inside the city of Jerusalem. But of course God looks for such special people. Perhaps Nehemiah's contemporaries should have considered the example of their patriarch Abraham. He had responded to God's call and left a settled and comfortable existence to go to an uncertain and potentially dangerous place. You remember these familiar words from Hebrews. By faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise, as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. In more recent times, Ezra had made the same journey round the Fertile Crescent. He too recognised the many dangers that might befall him on his travels, but he journeyed in the certainty of faith that the good hand of the Lord was on him. Nehemiah too had felt a calling to leave behind the luxury of the king's palace in order to go to a city whose wall was broken down, whose gates were burned with fire, and where the people were in great distress and reproach. Such men as Abraham, Ezra, and Nehemiah had provided the lead. The question that remained was how many of the Jews could be encouraged to follow that example. Well, although we're not told explicitly, it would seem that Nehemiah sought guidance from God as to how to encourage more Jews to return to the city. He certainly acknowledges God's role in developing the approach that was finally adopted, for, as you can see from Nehemiah chapter 7 and verse 5, "Then my God put it into my heart to gather the nobles, the rulers, and the people, that they might be registered by genealogy." So it seems that Nehemiah was guided by God to hold a census in order to number the people. And we'll see the reason for that census in a moment. Well, on an earlier occasion, David had been moved by God to number the people. The purpose on that prior occasion was to ascertain the strength of David's army. And the numbers that Joab reported to David are instructive in the context of our study. Joab told the king that the number of fighting men totaled nearly 1.3 million, a figure that excluded the Levites and the fighting men from the tribe of Benjamin. Yet from Nehemiah chapter 7 and verse 6 onward, we have the head count of those that returned with Zerubbabel. And verse 66 tells us that the whole assembly was only 42,600. That's a 30-fold reduction in numbers compared to the census that David took. Little wonder then that Jerusalem was sparsely populated. And remember that this estimate of a 30-fold reduction assumes that the two head counts numbered the same categories of people. Joab counted just the fighting men, whereas Zerubbabel's list included the whole assembly, a number that might also include older men, and perhaps women and or children too. If these additional categories are included in the register of the returning exiles, then the reduction in the Jewish population was even more dramatic. And so we can see the pressing need to encourage people to move back into Jerusalem. So how did Nehemiah set about meeting this challenge of encouraging the Jews to return? Well, as verse 5 says, he began by gathering the nobles and organising a census. And it is at this point that the order of the text seems quite confusing. The rest of chapter 7 does not contain a record of Nehemiah's census, but contains a record of those who returned under Zerubbabel and Joshua nearly 100 years earlier. It is essentially the same census data that is also given in Ezra chapter 2. As we say, there is no mention of Nehemiah's census here, and the next chapter, chapter 8 that we read with Brother Fred, goes on to record the great reading of the law during the feasts of the first month. It is not until we get to chapter 11 of Nehemiah that the registration of the nobles by Nehemiah seems to be picked up again. We read in chapter 7 and verse 5 that Nehemiah intended to gather the nobles, the rulers, and the people, that they might be registered by genealogy. And it is Nehemiah chapter 11 and verse 3 that seems to record the outcome of this action. In that verse, Nehemiah 11 and 3, we read, "These are the provincial leaders who settled in Jerusalem. Now some Israelites, priests, Levites, temple servants, and descendants of Solomon's servants lived in the towns of Judah, each on their own property in the various towns, while other people from both Judah and Benjamin lived in Jerusalem." The provincial leaders, or heads of the province, referred to in this passage from Nehemiah 11, equate to the nobles and rulers of chapter 7 that Nehemiah called together. And the rest of chapter 11 details who lived in Jerusalem and who in the country villages. So if it seems likely, chapter 11 is a continuation of the account of how Nehemiah intended to repopulate the city. Does it describe the strategy that he adopted? Well, indeed it does. for the process is described in the opening two verses of chapter 11. Now the leaders of the people dwelt at Jerusalem. The rest of the people cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 to dwell in Jerusalem, the holy city, and 9/10 were to dwell in other cities. And the people blessed all the men who willingly offered themselves to dwell at Jerusalem. From this we can see that there were 3 different strands to this repopulation strategy. Firstly, the provincial leaders all agreed to settle in Jerusalem. As the capital, the city was the administrative and commercial centre, so it was appropriate that the leaders of the people should make their base in the metropolis. Secondly, a decision was taken to require 10% of the population to move to Jerusalem. This 10% was selected by the casting of lots and would explain the need for the census that Nehemiah had organised. Although the cynic might regard the casting of lots as being somewhat of a haphazard approach, doubtless Nehemiah trusted in the ways of providence to bring to Jerusalem the men that he needed for the tasks in hand. As Proverbs states, the lot is cast into the lap, but his every decision is from the Lord. The third strand of people who repopulated Jerusalem were the volunteers. For as verse 2 states, the people blessed all the men who willingly offered themselves to dwell at Jerusalem. This group of men were not coerced or offered compensation, but willingly volunteered to occupy Zion. These were men with the same attitude as Abraham, Ezra, and Nehemiah. Men who willingly left their settled existence for an unknown and potentially dangerous future. Like Abraham, they were looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And of course they are a model and an inspiration for us. Our hoped-for citizenship of the New Jerusalem is not because we are obliged to dwell there, nor because we are forced to dwell there, but because we want to be there. Chapters 11 and 12 then detail who lived where in Judea. Lists of names are not easy to study, but one or two general observations may be of interest. Firstly, in all that list, only 3 of Israel's tribes are listed: Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. These, of course, were the tribes living in Judah and Jerusalem that Nebuchadnezzar had taken into captivity. And so one would expect them to form the bulk of the returned exiles. However, we know that some of the tribes of Asher, Ephraim, Manasseh, Issachar and Zebulun had responded to Hezekiah's appeal to come to Jerusalem to keep his great Passover. Yet none of these tribes are listed in Nehemiah's census. Perhaps none of these stayed in Jerusalem after Hezekiah's Passover feast, but returned to their ancestral homes in the territory dominated by the idolatrous practices of the kings of Israel. But even so, it is perhaps surprising that there remains no representative of any of the northern tribes. But the other, perhaps more interesting point is the mention of a group who are included 16 times in the list of names recorded in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. And one such mention is given here in Nehemiah chapter 11 and verse 21. But the Nethinim dwelt in Ophel, and Zihar and Gishpar were over the Nethinim. Well, the Nethinim were the temple servants who were responsible for many of the menial tasks in the temple. Their origin is a little obscure, but the word means given ones, and is usually thought to refer to foreign captives who were given as slaves to work in the temple. The first representatives of this group were probably the Gibeonites, the Canaanites who tricked Joshua into making a peace treaty through their subterfuge of patched sandals and mouldy bread. Although their lives were spared, we read that that day Joshua made the Gibeonites woodcutters and water carriers for the assembly to provide for the needs of the altar of the Lord at the place the Lord would choose, and that is what they are to this day. So we see from the days of Joshua to the time of Nehemiah, the Nethinim never abandoned their promised service. They experienced many occasions when Israel turned their backs on God, and they had to share the afflictions that were brought upon God's people. These afflictions included being taken into exile. Yet despite this, 392 of the Nethinim volunteered to return with Zerubbabel and Joshua. Yet more Nethinim volunteered to return with Ezra. Indeed, they outnumbered the Levites in that party. And now the Nethinim were one of the groups who volunteered to leave the country to come and live in Jerusalem. Or as Nehemiah 11:21 says, the Nethinim dwelt in Ophel, a place to the south of the Temple Mount. So through centuries and indeed through millennia, the Nethinim remained true to their oath that the forebears made with Joshua. What an example of consistent service they exhibit. An example that is all the more striking, given the fickleness of the nation that had enslaved them. So we've now reached the point in the return from exile where the temple has been rebuilt, the walls of the city have been repaired, and the population has been settled. Next came the most important part of the whole period. The Jews had returned to Judah and Jerusalem. Now they must return in fullness of heart to serve the Lord. And so we return to Nehemiah chapter 8 and verse 1, where we read, "Now all the people gathered together as one man in the open square that was in front of the water gate. And they told Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded Israel. So Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly of men and women, and all who could hear with understanding on the first day of the seventh month." Notice from those verses that it is the people who demand the law be read to them, rather than the rulers requiring that the people listen to it being read. That surely is a very encouraging sign. For on previous occasions, the Reformation had been led by the king, with the people following the king's commands out of habitual obedience rather than personal conviction. For example, we can see this in the reformations of Hezekiah and Josiah, where as soon as the faithful king is removed from the scene, the nation quickly reverts to idolatry. But in this case, the groundswell of enthusiasm for reform came from the people, though it was doubtless welcomed by Ezra and Nehemiah. And notice also that this enthusiasm was not from just a vocal minority, for verse 1 says, "All the people gathered together as one man." Clearly then, this was a genuine and comprehensive national reformation. And perhaps that is partly why one aspect of this reformation was to endure, for after the return from exile, the Jews never again reverted to the worship of gods of wood and stone. But what had prompted the people to assemble in this way? Well, as we read in verse 2, they assembled on the first day of the seventh month, which was the day of the Feast of Trumpets. The seventh month was the most important month of all in the Mosaic calendar, for the Feast of Trumpets was followed on the tenth day by the Day of Atonement. This was in turn followed by the Feast of Tabernacles, which began on the 15th day of the month. But this first day of the seventh month was a day that also had additional significance for the returned exiles. In Ezra 3, we read that on the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, although the foundation of the temple of the Lord had not been laid. So sacrifices had first been made on the reconsecrated altar on this same day, the day of the Feast of Trumpets. Now it was the time for the people to reconsecrate themselves. And who better to read and expound the law to them than the one described in Ezra 7 as a skilled scribe in the law of Moses? An interesting point arises from verse 1, where the people tell Ezra to bring the book of the law. I wondered what had happened to the books of the law when the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians. But it seems that at least one copy was taken into Babylon, along with the other temple treasures that Nebuchadnezzar had looted. When he returned with the second wave of exiles, we are told that Ezra brought with him a number of temple treasures that the Persian king wished to be returned to Jerusalem. And you will remember how Ezra distributed those valuables amongst his fellow travellers to spread the risk in case of attack by robbers. But it seemed possible that he kept the greatest treasure of all in his own possession. That particular treasure was a scroll of the law, maybe even the sole remaining copy. You might like to turn back to Ezra chapter 7 and verse 14, for that records the letter of authority that Artaxerxes gave to Ezra. See what Artaxerxes writes in this letter of authority. Ezra 7 and verse 14. You, Ezra, are being sent by the king and his seven counsellors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem with regard to the law of your God, which is in your hand. And that, surely, the last phrase is significant. To me, that seems to be saying that Ezra was personally carrying a scroll which Artaxerxes had entrusted to Ezra, in order that he might be able to teach the law to those Jews who were ignorant of it. And if this were the sole copy, we can understand the importance of the new office of religious scribe that seems to begin with Ezra. For new copies of this precious law would need to be made. And as the appointed guardian of this precious copy of the law, the people would need Ezra to bring out the original in order to hear it being read. And all who could hear with discernment assembled, as we see from Nehemiah chapter 8 and verse 3. Nehemiah 8 and 3, then he, Ezra, read from it in the open square that was in front of the water gate, from morning until midday, before the men and women and those who could understand. And the ears of all the people were attentive to the book of the law. What a contrast in that last phrase to the situation that exists today, at least in our country. All the people were attentive to the book of the law. It surely says much about this generation of Jews that they were so attentive to God's law as it was being read to them. So Ezra begins to read. And to do so, Nehemiah 8 and 4 tells us that Ezra the scribe stood on a platform of wood, which they had made for the purpose. Again, we need to notice the emphasis here. This platform had been specially prepared, and it was quite some platform. As we see from verse 4, it had to take the weight of 14 men. And the word that is translated platform literally means a tower. So it was probably quite tall, sufficiently high so that all the assembled crowd could see Ezra. Not only did this large platform tower have to be built specifically for the task, but a site had to be chosen such that it could accommodate all the people. These things indicate preparation. This then was no spur-of-the-moment decision, no flash in the pan. So Ezra begins to read in verse 5. Ezra opened the book in the sight of all the people, for he was standing above all the people. And when he opened it, all the people stood up. Again, I think there's another nice little detail here. We live in a society which glories in personality cults. But there is none of that in this verse. The people stood up, not when Ezra stood up, but when the book of the law was opened. It was the words of God that were being honoured, not the personality of man. This is also reflected in the way that Ezra starts. He does not begin by outlining his credentials as a skilled scribe in the law of Moses. Rather, as we see from verse 6, he begins with words of praise to God, a prayer to which all the people give their assent with a doubled amen. But Ezra was not alone in this instruction in the law, as we see from verses 7 and 8 of Nehemiah chapter 8. The Levites, Jeshua, Bani, Sherebiah, Jamin, Akkar, Shabbatai, Hodiah, Maaseiah, Gelita, Azariah, Jozabad, Hanan and Peliah, instructed the people in the law while the people were standing there. They read from the book of the law of God, making it clear and giving the meaning so the people understood what was being read. But various interpretations have been given for what is meant by the method of instruction described here. The Jewish Talmud makes a distinction between the various elements that are listed in verse 8. You see, the list of instructions begins with reading from the book of the law of God. This seems to be the direct reading from the Hebrew scroll. Then comes making it clear. This is the translation of the text into Aramaic, which would have been the first language of the majority of the returning exiles. Finally, there is giving the meaning, the provision of additional explanatory commentary. But whatever the precise format this teaching took, it clearly made its impact. For as verse 9 states, all the people wept when they heard the words of the law. This reaction surely indicates that the contents of the law had largely been lost until this time. For the people's reaction is very similar to that of Josiah when the book of the law was rediscovered in his day. But through their newly found understanding, the Jews realized they had drifted away from the pattern of life that was expected of them. Despite this, Ezra, Nehemiah, and the Levites all exhort the people, "This day is holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn nor weep." I'm sure that Ezra must have read words from the law that spoke of God's blessings that would come if they turned back to him with a full heart. Surely he would read words like these from Deuteronomy. "Now it shall come to pass when all these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord your God drives you, and you return to the Lord your God and obey his voice, according to all that I command you today, you and your children, with all your heart and with all your soul, that the Lord your God will bring you back from captivity and have compassion on you. He will prosper you and multiply you more than your fathers." And Ezra surely would also point out that the same law which had caused them such grief of mind also encouraged them to rejoice on occasions such as the new moon festivals, of which the Feast of Trumpets was the most important. But it is Nehemiah who ends the first day's instruction in the law with yet more encouragement and exhortation. In verse 10 he says to them, "Go your way, eat the fat, drink the sweet, and send portions to those for whom nothing is prepared, for this day is holy to our Lord. Do not sorrow, for the joy of the Lord is your strength." Perhaps Nehemiah was highlighting the fact that the temple had been rebuilt, the walls repaired, and that this was evidence of the fulfillment of those words from Deuteronomy that we quoted a moment ago. God was now with his people once more, and though national and personal reformation was still required, God's law also encouraged a time of rejoicing, and that such joy in the Lord would give them the strength to continue with their reformation. The literal translation of that phrase is, "Delight in Jehovah is a strong refuge." And that expression, "delight in Jehovah is a strong refuge," is a stark contrast to the general history of Israel. For so often their fathers had delighted in the gods of the surrounding nations, and as a result, defeat and exile had followed. But in line with God's promises, now they had returned to God, favour, security and blessing would follow. And so in verse 12 we read, "All the people went their way to eat and drink, to send portions and rejoice greatly, because they understood the words that were declared to them." But this was not the end of their learning from the law. We have just seen how that on the first day of the month, all the people gathered together as one man. Then if we go on to verse 13 of chapter 8, we see that on the second day, a smaller group came together for further instruction. Verse 13, now on the second day, the heads of the fathers' houses of all the people, with the priests and Levites, were gathered to Ezra the scribe in order to understand the words of the law. Again, a small but important point. The heads of the houses might have felt it was the young and inexperienced who needed further guidance. But no, they recognised the truth of David's words. He who rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. So they came together for more instruction to find out how they should judge God's people. And during that instruction, they found the portion of the law detailing the arrangements for the Feast of Tabernacles. Verse 17 tells us that the Feast of Tabernacles had not been kept since the days of Joshua. So instructions are sent out to all the people to collect leafy branches to make booths to dwell in for the duration of the 7 days of the feast. We read that this was a time of very great gladness, but it was also an opportunity for yet more instruction in the law. Verse 18, day by day, from the first day until the last, he read from the book of the law of God. For such public reading of the law during the Feast of Tabernacles was commanded in the law in these words. At the end of every 7 years, at the appointed time in the year of release, at the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses, you shall read this law before all Israel in their hearing. Well, the reading of the law, we're told, should occur in the seventh year, the year of release from debt. And if this was a year of release in Jerusalem, it would add to the general rejoicing. For as we saw in an earlier study, many of the Jews were heavy in debt. And we had seen how Nehemiah appealed to his fellow countrymen to restore now to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive groves, their houses, a hundredth of the money and the grain, the new wine and the oil that you had charged them. So they said, we will restore it, and will require nothing from them. We will do as you say. So this process seems to add weight to the idea that this was indeed a year of release. So we've had details of the Feast of Trumpets and the Feast of Tabernacles. But one surprising feature of this narrative is that there is no mention of the Day of Atonement. It should have come between the other two feasts. Leviticus says the Day of Atonement was to be on the 10th day of the month and was a day for the people to afflict their souls. Although it's not actually stated, I wonder if the ritual was being followed in the record of Nehemiah chapter 9, for the actions of the people seem to echo these words from Leviticus. If you look at Nehemiah chapter 9 and verse 1, we're told, now on the 24th day of this month, the children of Israel were assembled, with fasting, in sackcloth, and with dust on their heads. This seems to resonate with the way in which they might afflict their souls, as required on the Day of Atonement. Verse 2 goes on to say that they stood and confessed their sins and the iniquities of their fathers, which also resonates with the purpose of the Day of Atonement. But if this was their Day of Atonement, why did it take place on the 24th day, 2 weeks after the scheduled date? Well, the only suggestion I can make is that it was like the Feast of Tabernacles. The Jews were initially unaware of its requirements until they heard it read from the law. And once they were aware, time would be needed to select the two goats and to locate the uninhabited land where the scapegoat was to be taken. If time was indeed required to make these arrangements, perhaps the enactments of this most solemn day were deferred for 2 weeks. But such an action is not without precedent, for Hezekiah postponed the Passover in his days for a month, because, as 2 Chronicles states, they could not keep it at the regular time because a sufficient number of priests had not consecrated themselves, nor had the people gathered together at Jerusalem. But whatever the precise nature of this occasion, it was again a time when reading and reflection on that reading were given high priority, as we see from verse 3 of chapter 9. And they stood up in their place and read from the book of the law of the Lord their God for one fourth of the day, and for another fourth they confessed and worshipped the Lord their God. So on the Feast of Trumpets they had read the law from early morning until midday. Each day during the Feast of Tabernacles they had listened to the law being read. Now on this final occasion they had spent half the day reading and meditating on God's law. Well, so often we are quick to point the finger at Israel's waywardness. But in these chapters they present a powerful example for us to try and emulate. And as a result of their reading and meditation, a group of Levites lead the people in that great prayer of confession that is recorded in Nehemiah chapter 9. It is a prayer that recognises the repeated blessings of God, despite the nation's frequent backsliding. It is a succinct yet comprehensive account of the nation's history. It is a history with which we are very familiar. So we will go straight to the prayer's climax in verse 36 of Nehemiah chapter 9. Here we are, servants today, and the land that you gave to our fathers to eat its fruit and its bounty, here we are, servants in it. And it yields much increase to the kings you have set over us because of our sins. Also they have dominion over our bodies and our cattle at their pleasure, and we are in great distress. And because of all this we make a sure covenant and write it. Our leaders, our Levites and our priests seal it. So we see how their reading of the law had caused them to understand why they were still a subject people. It made them realise the only way to full restoration was through their devotion to God. And having come to that realisation, they make a firm commitment to keep the covenant that their forefathers had entered into. As we see from verse 38, it is the leaders, Levites and priests who set the example by publicly sealing their written commitment to the covenant. But the rest of the people were equally keen to follow suit, as verses 28 to 29 of chapter 10 make clear. Now the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, the Nethinim, and all those who had separated themselves from the peoples of the lands to the law of God, their wives, their sons and their daughters, everyone who had knowledge and understanding, these joined with their brethren, with their nobles, and entered into a curse and an oath to walk in God's law, which was given by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe and do all the commandments of the Lord our God, and his ordinances and his statutes. The covenant that they sealed committed the people to several key actions. First, not to marry with the pagan peoples of the land. Second, not to trade on the Sabbath. Third, to honour the Sabbath year by allowing the land to rest and by the cancelling of all debts. Fourth, to pay the annual levy of one-third of a shekel to maintain the temple services. As an aside, it is interesting to note that Exodus chapter 30 specifies the amount as half a shekel, not a third. Was this difference a practical response to the recognition of the impoverished state of the people? Or is it that the record in Exodus requires the half shekel to be paid when there was a census, whereas the commitment in Nehemiah chapter 10 is to an annual levy? They also committed to offer the first fruits of the ground and of the flock as an offering to the Lord, and they committed to the payment of the tithe in support of the Levites. Despite what I feel sure was a genuine commitment, we find the cycle that is so clearly identified in that great prayer of Nehemiah 9 repeats itself once again. If you go on to the last chapter of Nehemiah, chapter 13, it tells us how that Nehemiah returned to Babylon for an unspecified period, but that when he came back to Jerusalem once again, he had to deal with the failure of the people to keep several of those specific commitments. Nehemiah discovers that the people had ceased paying the tithes, verses 10 to 14. And Eliashib, the high priest of all people, had cleared out the rooms dedicated to store the tithes in order to create a city apartment for Tobiah the Ammonite. When Nehemiah clears out all Tobiah's belongings, he demands the rulers reinstate the tithe and appoints treasurers to administer its distribution. These treasurers are described as men who were considered faithful, a description that must apply to Nehemiah above all others. Nehemiah also finds people were working and trading on the Sabbath, verses 15 to 22. It's clear that Jerusalem had become a busy centre of trade. Jews were bringing in wine, grapes, figs and all kinds of burdens. Men from Tyre, that great trading nation, were bringing in fish and other goods. So Nehemiah orders that the gates of the city be kept shut on the Sabbath to prevent the movement of these trading goods. That the traders just set up their stalls outside the city walls until they're driven off by the threat of force. Nehemiah also discovers that Jews had married women of Ashdod, Ammon and Moab. Well, we looked at this issue previously, so we won't think about it again now. So we see how Nehemiah deals with each of these lapses in his usual forthright way. And the book ends with that repeated prayer, "Remember me, O my God, for good." Surely he could have made the same confident claim as that other great servant of God. "I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day." And so we bring to an end this study of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Arising out of the desolations caused by the Babylonian invasion, the temple had been rebuilt, the services reinstituted, and the city made secure. But as we have just seen, there is the ever-present fallibility of human nature, as good intentions give way to forgetfulness. Left to men, Jerusalem will never truly be the city of God, the joy of the whole earth. For what Zerubbabel, Joshua, Haggai, Zechariah, Ezra and Nehemiah laboured so hard to achieve was once again to be destroyed by an army who came in judgment against the waywardness of the Jews. So we close with words from the Psalms, words which I think summarise in a few succinct phrases the abiding lessons of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Their words taken from Psalm 127. "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labour in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain."